Hello and welcome to episode 15 of Checking the Gate podcast. I'm Robert Wright Stasko.
And with him, as always, is Michael M. Patty, Esquire.
But Mike is joining us through the miracle that is Skype today because of unforeseen travel circumstances.
We just couldn't get to each other's house today, so yeah. We're trying this. This is literally my first time using Skype, so we're going to see how this goes and hope it doesn't sound too bad. Robert assures me it doesn't, so here you go.
Yeah, we'll do the best we can on this end. So today, we're talking about Prometheus. We're going to give you a big spoiler alert right here at the beginning. If you've not seen the movie, stop now.
If you've not seen the movie, why are you listening to a podcast about the movie?
So maybe they just like the sound of our voices. So, but yes, go out and see it now. It's not
still
the big.
Playing.
Yes, still playing. It's not the biggest movie of the year. That honor belongs to the Avengers, but you can still see it. Will probably be coming out this fall on DVD. We wanted to talk about it because there is a talk about it on the internet through journals and blogs and video blogs, and we really have to put our two cents in because there is a lot going on in this movie.
Yes, there is. It takes place in the same universe as the four previous standalone Alien movies, not counting the two Alien vs. Predator movies, just to be clear. All through the production, the director, Ridley Scott, as you constant listeners know, we're big Ridley Scott fans here at CTG, and the writer, Damon Lindelof, were saying it's not really a prequel to Alien. It shares some of the same DNA, and viewers of those movies might find things in this film that they recognize. And it sounded a lot like weasel words, the way they were explaining it at that time. And then having seen the movie, everything they said about that was absolutely right. It really is only tangentially related to mostly the first Alien movie, although a little bit of the second one as well. Shall I give the plot summary?
Sure, go ahead.
All right. It's about a ragtag fleet of scientists and crew members aboard the good ship Prometheus. And along with a corporate executive and an android, who, while before they leave, two of the scientists discover the 10th in a series of Franklin Mint cave paintings that depict a large humanoid figure pointing to the stars at various different sites in different cultures. So they realize they're pointing to a constellation, and that's where they need to go to discover the origins of man. And they get there, and bad stuff goes down, and that's when it turns into Alien 5. Sort of.
Sort of, yeah. There are several characters of interest in this movie. Probably the most interesting.
There's one character of interest in this movie.
We're thinking of David, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the android steals the show in this one.
Absolutely. Michael Fassbender.
Yeah. And then there's, in terms of the religious content of the movie, Elizabeth Shaw, played by Noomi Rapace.
I hope saying that right.
Me too. She is supposed to be a scientist and also a woman of faith. I'm not sure how well that was portrayed in the movie.
She had a cross. Obviously, she was religious.
Yeah. They talk about, at the beginning, when David's watching her dreams. She's dreaming of her father and, I guess, time they spent in Africa. And they're talking about their beliefs, like, they don't believe what we believe. And it's obviously her father's cross that she's holding. And I think that's more of a memento of her father than it is a touchstone for her faith. That's what it seemed to me in the movie.
That's a good interpretation. I hadn't made that connection that it was after her father. I just thought it was, for lack of a better word, a throwaway to, you know, she has this faith in religion represented by this little cross necklace, and that's why she decides to go halfway across the galaxy to find the creators of life, whether it be God or engineers or what have you.
Right. And she, when they have the initial briefing to all the other crew who kind of signed up with not knowing what they're doing, she explains to them they're going to this planet to find what they call the engineers, and one of them scoffs and says, you know, you're just going to throw away 300 years of evolutionary theory. No, because this kind of goes into the intelligent design creationist evolutionary debate. You know, is it all chance or is there some design? And one of the ways that people get around the creationist part in intelligent design is saying, well, it could be aliens. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories saying that, you know, aliens planted life here. And that, I think that's a track that this movie is taking.
Don't you mean there are those who believe that life here began out there?
That's right.
I suppose that's as plausible a theory as any.
Yeah. But I have a counter theory.
Okay.
We'll get to some of the other theories. But mine is that the engineers we see are not the ones who are the ultimate people pulling the strings.
Well, that's kind of what they hint at the end of the movie when they fly away in search of where the engineers came from.
Yeah. And here's what I think, that the engineers aren't the ones who engineered the black goo. Because the opening scene, we see an engineer drink some of that stuff, and he falls into a waterfall and kind of disintegrates, and it seems like he's seeding life on a planet.
Should have checked the expiration date on that.
Yeah. That is some bad goo. But here's what I think. That's not Earth. I mean, that's what you want to think. But if that was it, that would have to be something like 3 billion years ago. And to think that, you know, a race of aliens would remain essentially unchanged for 3 billion years, I mean, that seems highly unlikely to me. I think it's more likely that that's probably some other planet, and they're just setting up who these aliens are for the storytelling purposes.
Okay, that's a good theory. I heard that Ridley Scott is on record as saying it doesn't matter where that is at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
It's just, like what you said, an entry into those characters. What's not to say that something similar didn't happen on Earth either? So,
right. Well, what I think is some other aliens had come down and taken proto-humans and advanced their evolution to the state where we see them as the engineers in this movie, and that they had taken these few beings, these engineers, and used them for their own test, and used them sort of like Fry and Futurama. They're the intergalactic errand boys, you know? So, because who's going to handle all your black goo? Are you going to do it yourself, or are you going to raise up a slave race to take care of it for you? So they're going to deliver the goo to Earth and create all their weapons. Because we're genetically the same, because they showed that in the movie, that humans and the engineers are genetically exactly the same. Then I fail to see how they could have begun life on Earth, waited 3 billion years, and it'd still be exactly the same. You know what I'm saying?
It's relativity, and time passes differently the further away you get from Earth.
Oh, yeah. Well, it only took them 4 years to get to this other planet, right?
Yeah, but they didn't come from that planet.
Yeah.
All right, that's a lot more thought out than my theory. My theory, I came up with this while we were still in the theater before the movie even ended. And it kind of makes sense, just based on what's superficially in the movie. Like I've already said, it doesn't matter what planet that is at the beginning. Let's say the same thing did happen on Earth. Maybe not 3 million years ago, maybe at the dawn of man, a couple hundred thousand. Okay?
Okay, I see that.
Now, later on in the movie, the captain of the ship, Idris Elba, somehow draws the conclusion that the planet they're on is a weapons production facility by the engineers that they have come to find. it's not really clear. I'll admit this is not a perfect movie, and there are narrative lapses at a few places. This is one of them. It's not really clear how he up and decides that a whole bunch of dead bodies with no discernible threat equals weapons production facility. But okay, it's in the movie. For the sake of argument, let's say he's correct. The black goo is apparently a means of altering the stuff of life. We see it dissolve the engineer at the beginning of the movie. We see it alter those two worms inside the chamber. They turn into those monsters that kill the geologist and the other guy. I don't remember any of those guys' names, by the way.
You don't need to.
I don't need to. They were the first ones down. I'd like to say on the record, Robert thought those guys were going to make it.
I thought they were so stupid they just kind of blunder their way through to the end.
No, not so much. They were red shirts. So, armed with that knowledge, that this stuff alters their body chemistry, to coin a phrase, on the cave wall, there is a drawing of the alien queen, which is the reference to the second Alien movie, Aliens,
yes,
that I referred to earlier. There's a picture of that clearly. So, obviously, the engineers had met one or had designed one.
Right.
I'm thinking, what if that black goo that caused the destruction of the engineer on quote-unquote Earth, that I believe, if I'm remembering right, because it's been a couple weeks since the movie came out, if I'm remembering right, something about the goo made the engineer head explode on the ship, and it transformed the worms, and eventually it started transforming some of the crew members also into different monsters that were coming back to the ship and could potentially do it harm, like Dr. Shaw's boyfriend, who may or may not have also been a scientist. That is also not clear. He doesn't do very much science. And
there's not a whole lot of science going on at all in this expedition.
No. David decides to infect him to see what it would do, just because he was curious. So he puts a drop of it in Science Guy's vodka, and he gets Dr. Shaw pregnant, and where previously she was barren, that's not a religious iconography.
On Christmas Eve?
On Christmas Eve.
They make a point, it's Christmas Eve, the Virgin Earth.
She has to have a beastie extracted from her forcibly. And eventually, spoiler alert, but again, you should have seen the movie already, this thing turns into a giant face hugger and births a xenomorph out of an engineer at the end of the movie. So, my theory, based on all of that, the fact that there's an alien creature at the end of the movie that we have seen before, the fact that one of those said creatures is on a cave painting, the fact that these engineers are established to be bringers, if not absolute creators of life, lead me to believe, along with Idris Elba's dialogue, that it's a weapons factory, lead me to believe that, much like the Weyland-Yutani Corporation of the previous movies, the purpose of the engineers is to create a weapon, and that weapon is the xenomorph we are all familiar with.
Right.
And perhaps the dawn of humanity was an attempt to bring this species about or back from extinction or whatever. That's not clear. And that's why the one engineer was so upset when David brought humans back to them that he just went batty. What are you doing here? You're just chattel. You're brood mares, if you will, for the things I really worship and the bringers of mass destruction.
Right. And I think what you said right there at the end, the things I really worship, because when you look at the way that, I guess it was like a bas relief on the wall of the queen alien and stuff, and then there was like a table in front of it. Like the aliens were the things that they serve, that they worship.
Yeah, it looked a lot like a temple with an altar, didn't it?
Yes, it did. That's what it looked like to me. Someone, one of the characters says this looks like a tomb. But to me, it looked, with all the murals on the ceiling, and it was kind of a dome structure. From the outside, it's definitely a dome structure, but
the giant face.
Yeah, it was very much like, it looked like a church walking in there, but instead of pews, you had the, you know, the bottles of black goo.
What that reminded me of, all the different vases on the floor, it reminded me of the field of eggs from Alien, which I'm sure was on purpose.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if the ship that we see on LV-426 was the one that we saw leaving LV-223 at the end of this movie.
I think that's certainly possible, and it leaves it wide open for Prometheus 2.
Yeah.
Or Deucalion, if you will.
Yeah, I really hope they don't make a sequel to this movie. I don't think it needs one.
I kind of hope they do. I wouldn't mind seeing a little more of David and Dr. Shaw and the engineers. We should point out, again, to make it clear, the connection between this movie and Alien is that in Alien, the large creature that's sitting in what looks like a gun, who he's referred to as the space jockey, it turns out he is one of these engineers. And all of Prometheus is about his species and what happens to him. And in Alien, he's sitting at what turns out in Prometheus to be the control panel of one of their ships. And he has a burst chest. So obviously something gets back on board.
Right.
Because they would have to have, presumably that ship that they left on would have a sleeping engineer and black goo.
Yeah.
And humans with which to create aliens.
Right, yeah. I like our ideas better than some of the stuff that's been going out online, like...
And admittedly, we're just coming up with crackpot theories the same as everybody else, because the truth is, there are no concrete answers in this movie. To make it clear, there are some legitimate mysteries in the movie, and that's completely separate from some of the bad screenwriting in the movie.
Right.
Like, I mean, Dr. Shaw has the cesarean and then runs, not walks, into the chamber where they're defrosting. For Guy Pearce, who is for some reason in old age makeup as old Mr. Wayland, who is believed to be dead. And like stuff like, why did he let people think he was dead and instead of being on the ship? Everybody just looks at her and nobody says, what just happened to you? And she also doesn't seem to be the least bit fazed by him being alive, and not even just alive, but also on the ship. You know, that kind of thing. Some of that is just shortcutting.
Yeah.
There's allegedly going to be a longer version on the DVD and Blu-ray later this year that will maybe answer some of those questions. We're going to try and focus on the actual mysteries, and they're not answered in this movie. They weren't meant to be answered in this movie, and even if they were, they'd just be made up sci-fi hokum anyway.
Right, and I think that's the point of this movie, is to make you think and draw your own conclusions. Like
absolutely. And to show a xenomorph at the end.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're all waiting for.
I have to admit, this movie 100% met my expectations. It was not completely brainless action. It had cool designs, and then a xenomorph at the end. That's exactly what I wanted, and I got it.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to seeing the longer version.
It does touch on the deeper questions. Where do we come from? Why are we here?
Do you think that this movie is actually designed to spark discussion and get people to think, or is it more of just a MacGuffin to move the plot along and get you to this other planet where violence ensues?
I think it might be a little bit of both, but I think in ultimate reality, I think Ridley Scott making a film to make you think.
It could have been anything. They could have gotten a signal, you know.
Yeah.
They could have already been in space and gotten a signal and gone to the planet, and then everything happens the same way it did, except for the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, but I like the way they set the movie off by finding the cave drawings and all these different civilizations. There's even a verse in Genesis that might point to the same thing as evidence of engineers in Genesis 6:4.
And there's no reply at all. No reply at all.
But
is anybody listening?
But before I read this verse, I just want to say this is one that most theologians don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole, just because it's sort of weird and out there. We don't know why it's there, but here it is. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. So,
like Perseus.
Yeah.
In Wrath of the Titans.
Yes, like Hercules. engineers.
Kevin Sorbo.
Like engineers. And this also brings up the theory that's been going around of the space Jesus. What do you think about this? This is from an article on LiveJournal by a fellow with the handle Cavalorn. He points out a lot of the obvious, Greek references to, Prometheus. He gets his side ripped open and eaten out by an eagle. He gets his liver eaten. And everyone gets their abdomen torn open in this movie. There's lots of fire. Prometheus brought fire to humans. He formed men out of clay, like God in Genesis, or as the engineers supposedly did. He points that those obvious things, but then he refers to another interview with Ridley Scott. And the interviewer asks, because there's a line of dialogue like, the engineers on the planet were dead for like 2,000 years. So it's assumed that 2,000 years ago, they were massing all this black goo to take to Earth to destroy humanity. And it's like, well, what set them off? Well, maybe they sent an emissary in the form of Jesus, who's like half alien, half human now. And since we crucified him, that made the engineers mad, and that's why they want to sick all their xenomorphs on us. What do you think of the space Jesus theory?
I like that the guy, Mr. Cavalorn, put that much effort into a really well-written and well-analyzed blog posting. I think it's definitely food for thought. I'm not sure there's anything actually in the movie to corroborate that, but it's really good connecting the dots of all the imagery, and it's something I never would have thought of on my own. And, again, it's something else to think about, just another reason this... In a movie that's about aliens melting your face off with their acid blood, it's good that something like this, whether or not it's even remotely accurate based on what's in the movie, it's good that you can think of something like this. And it's just as valid as what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah, it is, like I said, this movie is designed to provoke thought, and so you, the watcher, would draw your own conclusions. And I agree with you. I thought his analysis was very well thought out, but I still do not like his idea of the space Jesus. For a couple reasons. First, the idea of the space Jesus is not a new one. It's one that has apparently been going around for a while. There's a video blog by Comic Book Girl 19. She talks about where the original space Jesus idea came from and that aliens even gave Moses the Ten Commandments to kind of put us on our way. So it's like the government has some red book that gives the truth about all of history. So it's very... conspiracy theory. It sounds like something Giorgio Tsoukalos from the Ancient Alien show would come up with.
I don't know who's on the Ancient Aliens show. You should be ashamed of yourself.
It's a guilty pleasure. I'm sorry. But I don't know. It does connect some of the dots, but not all of them. I think it might be just a coincidence that it was 2,000 years ago that they were setting off. Because I don't think that the engineers are completely altruistic.
Well, no, because they went to town as soon as they saw humans and androids. They just started wrecking the place. So obviously they're not, they didn't greet humans, whether or not they look at humans as their creation, with open arms. Yeah. It's unclear what their motives were.
Yeah.
Should it have been? I don't know.
Yeah, because, like Job... in the Bible, who had all this bad stuff happening to him, and he had no idea why. It turned out to be a wager between God and Satan, and had nothing to do with anything he was doing. It was just happening to him. The same thing with the characters in this movie. They have no idea why the stuff is happening to them, and they are drawing their own conclusions about it. But
it's,
I think they're all wrong.
It's clear the engineers are not God.
Right, but they are human. They have that point where they test their genetics, and they're exactly genetically the same as us, human. So I would go as far to say that they are like us in many other ways. Our agendas change all the time. We could have a good agenda 1 minute and then a bad agenda the next. And they might have seeded life on Earth thousands or millions or billions of years ago. But then maybe there's factions of these engineers where some of them are good and want to start life, and then there's some who use their technology to destroy life with their xenomorphs. I think the goo at the beginning of the movie is different than the goo at the end of the movie, because the goo at the beginning, it just disintegrated that guy. Like you pointed out, the goo in the rest of the movie turns everyone into acid-spitting, you know, xenomorph...
wannabes.
Yeah. So Waylon's wrong, because he's assuming that these guys are going to, you know, if they gave life in the first place, they're going to give him more. He finds out pretty quick how wrong he is. Shaw says to them, you know, why do you hate us? Because she kind of subscribes to Captain Jenik's theory that, you know, this is a weapons facility. He's like, why do you want to destroy us? And, you know, maybe it has nothing to do with loving or hating us, or like Cavalorn's theory is that the black goo takes what's in you, and if you're a good person, you take the black goo.
It's like the super soldier. It's like the super soldier serum in Captain America, where it takes what you are and amplifies it.
Yeah. Yeah, like instead of turning into Red Skull, you turn into a queen alien or something. Yeah, I don't think it works that way. I think they designed this black goo to turn you into a facehugger or an alien or...
And it's not until an engineer gets infected through the monster that comes out of Dr. Shaw that it succeeds in that.
Right. And, you know, we see the carcasses of other engineers kind of piled up with their chests bursted out. So I think it was like one of our experiments that go bad. I mean, we see that all the time. Why couldn't it have happened to the engineers, you know? Comic Book Girl 19 also points out another biblical connection. LV-223 might refer to Leviticus 22:3. It's a verse that says, "Say to them, for generations to come, if any of your descendants is ceremonially unclean and yet comes near the sacred offerings that the Israelites consecrate to the Lord, that person must be cut off from my presence, for I am the Lord." So you can see how that kind of relates to Waylon's character. He's ceremonial unclean, and he gets cut off pretty quickly by the engineer coming close to their sacred offerings, the jars of black goo. There's not a whole lot of other relevant religious imagery other than Shaw's arc. Like I said earlier, I don't think she's a person of profound Christian faith. She seems more like an open-minded scientist who's not locked into one theory or another, but is open to any kind of possibility, and she's still searching for answers, and that, you know, she's convinced that, you know, the engineers are set against us, but I think she might find other answers. And I think that that's the point of the movie, is to keep asking questions and to keep seeking the answers, because we're never gonna know it all, even though I might give the impression that I think I know it all. You know,
and if it gets viewers to go see the movie multiple times and to buy it when it comes out on disc, that's okay, too.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, Mike, you want to talk about David and, like, the implications of creating artificial life?
There is a line of dialogue that he has, and I'm going to try and paraphrase it as best I can, but it's been a while, where he's talking, before he poisons, I think his name is Charlie, the non-science scientist, the boyfriend.
Yeah.
The boyfriend is in the kitchen moping that they flew thousands of miles across the galaxy and all they got was a lousy t-shirt. And everything was dead. Rather than being excited that they found the first existence of extraterrestrial civilization, he was upset that everything was already dead. And David, who was created by humans in their image and who fancies himself like Lawrence of Arabia, Peter O'Toole, with the blonde hair and manner of speaking, he's trying to imitate this that he sees on the screen, and he sees the humans upset that their creators are no more, and he says he's not programmed to feel... He and Charlie are talking, and Charlie's upset that they got all the way out there, and in his mind there was nothing to see. And David asks, well, what would you have felt if you had gotten there and they had thought you were a disappointment? And he said, well, I would have not felt very good. And David said, imagine how that must feel to me.
Yeah, it's a similar theme that Scott explored in the original Alien and really expounded upon in Blade Runner, which we've already discussed at length. Yeah. You know what?
This is what, our third Ridley Scott movie?
Yeah. Well, he
Blade Runner, Kingdom of Heaven, and now this.
Yeah.
Next month, G.I. Jane.
the theme here is, you know, seeking acceptance. You know, David's seeking acceptance from his father. So is Vickers, played by Charlize Theron. So is Shaw. She's seeking acceptance as well.
From a father figure who's not there anymore.
Right.
Exactly. A lot of people, I've seen in a lot of comments on threads about this movie, they weren't sure what the point of Vickers being Waylon's daughter was. And the point is that if she's his actual daughter, then he says at the beginning of the movie that David, who he created, is the closest thing he'd ever have to a son. So she's got daddy issues. That's what the point of her being his kid is, that he loves his own creation more than his flesh and blood. And that's her motivation to, you know, run the type of ship she does. And that's why she doesn't care so much about meeting the engineers.
Right.
It's all she can do to get her father to notice her. She doesn't care about the creators of human life.
And if you examine Waylon's motives, you understand why he's on the ship and why it's important for his character to be there. You know, because people learn, why is the old guy on the ship and why this, why that?
Why did he lie about being on the ship?
Well, because his
That's
sole,
not really fear.
His sole purpose was to save his own self. His primary love is not Vickers, it's not David, it's his own life, and he wants more of it. So, you know, why finance a trip 4 years and billions of miles to this planet to chase a pipe dream of a few people who we know are not really scientists at all? They found a few cave drawings and said, hey, let's go, you know, halfway across the galaxy. It's because this guy is going to go and get more life. He's the one who's going to do it.
He hears that they discovered this, and that may be the answer, and that he can finance the ship and then freeze himself along with everybody else and go out there with them. That's fine. Why is it a mystery that he's on the ship?
I think
other than it's a reveal in the movie.
I don't think there's any other reason other than it's a reveal in the movie. It's a contrivance by Damon Lindelof.
By Damon Lindelof. What? Damon Lindelof had a contrivance?
Yeah, just wait till they find the hatch on the moon. On LV-223, wait till they find that hatch. You watch out.
I bet I know what's in it.
Nothing.
Newt. Newt's in the hatch.
All right. Well, we have explored everyone else's theories and given you our own. Is there anything else that you want to talk about Prometheus, Mike?
Yeah, not with Prometheus. I think we've done it as good as we're going to do it. So to anybody listening, make some comments, send us some tweets and some emails. We'd love to hear from you because this has been a really polarizing movie and we both really liked it, Robert and I. It was just a lot of fun. I'm not a huge Alien movie fan, but I'm casually, so I enjoyed this for what it was, and I'm glad it wasn't just, you know, mindless chest bursting. I'm glad it wasn't AVP3.
Yes. Well, you know, that brings up another point. You think this movie retcons the AVP movies? Because there was a Furious Fanboys blog that said it did. I don't think so.
I don't think it matters.
Those movies are so inconsequential, it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Exactly.
To kind of coincide with our conversation on Prometheus, we have some extras from episode 10 on Paul. We both kind of ranted a little bit more about the creation versus evolution debate. So this is sort of the third month in a row that we've continued with the anniversary celebration with some of the extras from other episodes. So we're going
to God help us when we get to our second anniversary. We're gonna have to record an entirely new show.
So here, enjoy these extra thoughts from Paul.
We'll be right back. I thought we would discuss a little more the concept of evolution and
right.
the idea that I disagree with the notion that she presents that just because something is so complex that it must have been supernatural. That's coming from a human perspective. You know, that's like saying, I can't draw, therefore every painting must be done with superpowers.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a fallacious assumption that I don't know where that came from.
Well, this is a very old argument. It's the watchmaker argument where, like, you're walking along the beach and you see a stopwatch lying there. And you pick it up, you look at it, and you see it had to have been designed, it had to have been manufactured. You have to think, well, there has to be an ultimate designer somewhere.
It's only complex because we're human. It's a leap.
Yeah, well, there's evolutionist argument that Connor Mann sets. Take, for example, a game of cards.
Okay.
Okay, and at the end of this game, you have, like, a royal flush, Mike. And
is that good?
It's a good hand.
All right.
But you arrived at this totally by chance.
Yes.
All right, but if you go back hand by hand, back chronologically, and you look at how you received all your cards and the bets that you made, and if you could track how these things happen, you could say, well, this had to have happened by design. By going backwards, you can make that argument. But as you're going forwards, it was nothing but chance. This was brought up in, I believe, the movie Expelled with Ben Stein. It's a movie about not so much creationism versus evolution, but sort of the debate in the scientific community with evolution and intelligent design, which is sort of a thinly veiled
yeah.
creationist.
I'd like to go on record as saying intelligent design should not be taught anywhere because it has no there's nothing scientific about intelligent design.
It's bad religion and it's bad science.
Thank you, Robert.
When I read the Bible, the way I approach it is I try and use the reason that God gave me, that he gifted me with, that he uses other parts of the Bible to train my wisdom in. You know, Proverbs, books of that Solomon wrote. These things help you develop your wisdom, and then that helps you read other parts of the Bible, like Genesis. That's not literally true, but there's a truth there that, yes, God did make us. If you look at the first 3 days of creation, it was God forming the earth, and then in the next 3 days, he fills it with the fish and the birds, and then the animals, and then humans on the sixth day. So there's this nice little theme that starts in Genesis, of forming and filling. You know, God forms a man out of the dust and he fills him with his spirit. And you find this all through the book of Genesis, and it's a theme that sort of sets up the whole Bible. And you miss out on that if you're just looking at it, well, this is the way it did, it's exactly this. And that's my beef with it.
Can't we just chalk it up to people who wrote the Bible getting their numbers wrong? Isn't that, you know, Occam's razor? The easiest explanation is most often the correct one.
Right. Well, I don't think it's a question of numbers. I don't think they intended to write it literally. People have always seen the world as more than what it is. I mean, you look at some of the cave drawings you see in caves in France, and yeah, they're drawing pictures of horses and stuff, but they also, there's a picture of a Minotaur in there,
mm-hmm.
something that didn't exist, but clearly they're using their imagination to do something. So we've always been creative, imaginative creatures. So trying to ponder how the world was created without the scientific equipment and telescopes we have today, of course we're going to go into a creative realm, especially if God's sort of showing and revealing stuff that we can't fully understand. We're going to write it down in a way that we can relate it to other people.
You also just sort of implied that they may have imagined God creating the earth. Altogether.
Well, yeah, well, we had to imagine it because we weren't there, right? So even if God gave us a direct revelation of this is exactly how it happened, then, you know, how do you write that out? How do you communicate that? How do you,
well, exactly.
So there has to be an interpretation that happens as it's being written. And then there's further interpretation as it's being read.
I think you just backed up my point.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I'm agreeing with you, sir.
The long way.
The long way, yeah. My wife hates it when I do that because she's like, it sounds like you're arguing with me. I'm like, no, I'm totally backing up your point. Well, then stop yelling at me.
I haven't had a lot to do this episode. It's great.
That's all I have to say about it. That's sort of my soapbox. I live in a community where there's a creationist museum, so, and I'm one of those guys who believes that, yes, God created the heavens and the earth, but he used evolution to get us to where we are today. And I'm kind of, as the statistics I threw up show, I'm in a minority.
Yeah.
So I'm taking my little time here on my podcast to firm up my position. So I apologize if I've ranted more than usual.
If I can contribute my two cents here, I promise I won't go on quite so long. But I can't help but think that, like I said before, it's hard for me to accept the Bible as being literal just because that's what my parents told me was the right way. I have a feeling that, to kind of go along with what Robert said, my feeling is that somebody had the idea, call it a revelation, maybe it was from God, maybe he made it up, I don't know. And I can't just take any written word, especially one that, to go back to my point, was so ancient, written before there was the kind of learning and curiosity, if you will, when the easiest way to explain something was just to say a supernatural entity did it just because humans can't. I think that's short-sighted, and that stops at saying humans are the next best thing to God, which is clearly not the case. One thing that I like as a non-believer, a phrase I heard one time was, if God created humans, he didn't do a very good job. So who's to say that I don't want to discount the possibility? Because I don't know. It has not been revealed to me. And I'm okay with that. I don't need to know how the universe was created. I've seen enough in science books and documentaries. There seems to be a predominant case for evolution over time and dinosaurs dying out and giving rise to cold-blooded reptiles and even birds today. There seems to be some sort of evidence of that, whether or not that was set in motion by the character depicted in the Bible known as God, whether or not whether or not Jesus could walk on water or heal the sick or just knew where the rocks and the good medicine was. Again, I'm not there, and it's 2,000 years later, and I'm okay with that.
All right, before we go, a program note. I was invited to appear on another podcast hosted by some friends of mine. It is Cinefilter, which is found at CINEFILTER.com. It's a good bunch of guys, and I know them, and they asked, since I am now an experienced podcaster, if I would like to join them on their show to talk about movies like I am wont to do. And I said yes, and so we discussed Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. We weren't about to talk about Checking the Gate, because there is no religious content to be found. So you can hear my thoughts on Cinefilter, the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter episode. The episode isn't online as of this recording, but you know, look for it. Probably by the time we post it, it will be. They're pretty good about getting things out on schedule, so look for that. That's cinefilter.com, and for those of you who remember, Matt, a.k.a. Big Hungry, is the one who recommended Blade Runner to us, and Finn is the one who suggested Red State, so they're friends of the show, and I felt like an honored guest there. It was good to go on there, and I hope you like it.
And I was also on another podcast as well. I don't know if I told you about this, but
you did not.
On the Sci-Fi Guys podcast, you can find it at www.dtrn.co.uk. It's season 5, episode 17. I wrote a song called Never Go Drinking with Obi-Wan Kenobi. And
they played that?
They played that at the end of their episode. So if you want to hear that, you can find it on their downloads page. But if you want to contact us, Mike wanted to hear what you have to think about Prometheus, and so do I. You can go to ctgpodcast@yahoo.com, send us an email. Go to twitter.com/ctgpodcast, facebook.com/ctgpodcast, or you can go to our website at www.ctgpodcast.com.
And before I forget, our new logo was made by the third leg of the Cinefilter three-legged table, Nick Lake.
Yes, and it is a really awesome logo. I tweeted a thank you, and I'd like to thank you again, Nick, for designing that really awesome logo. So thank you. Well, for next time, we're going to be watching the newly reconstructed Fritz Lang masterpiece, The Complete Metropolis. Do not settle for any dollar store public domain release. Get the DVD or the Blu-ray that's released by Kino International, or Mike told me that you could find it on Netflix. Just search for Metropolis Restored and you can find the correct version. Trust me, you'll be glad you did. And in the TV corner, we're going to make long-suffering Mike suffer some more by examining the short-lived Battlestar Galactica prequel series Caprica. It is available on Blu-ray and DVD, and the entire series can also be streamed on Netflix. But if you just want to catch the pilot episode, which is split up into two parts on Netflix, that'll give you the gist of it. So until next time, this is Robert saying keep the faith.
And this is Mike saying peace out.